free outdoor screenings of documentary films about rock and roll and other contemporary music topics. The series continues on Monday, April 25th with The Devil and Daniel Johnston, a glimpse into the life of outsider artist Daniel Johnston, a cult indie folk musician from Texas. May 2nd features Still Bill, a recent portrait of the working-class soul hero Bill Withers. May 9th brings us Scratch, an exploration of the world of the hip-hop DJ. On May 16th, there will be a screening of the hard-to-find movie Vinyl, a look at compulsive vinyl record collecting. Rest in Peace, a remix manifesto, follows on May 23rd, the story of the energetic, innovative, and potentially illegal world of Mashup Media, which features musician Greg Gillis, a.k.a. Girl Talk. The series concludes with Madonna, Truth or Dare, on June 6th. Rock Doc screens outdoors at the Music Bowl, an intimate outdoor amphitheater within the Department of Music facility at the University of California, Santa Barbara campus. Just bring snacks, padding, added warmth, and a love of music to this free weekly festival at 8 p.m. on Monday at UCSB. For more information, go to music.ucsb.edu or kcsb.org.
Than a roller coaster, love like yours will surely come my way.
The Barefoot Runners Society and Soul for Souls present the Naked Foot 5K race on May 21st, starting at Chase Palm Park near Stearns Wharf in Santa Barbara. Running events begin at 8 a.m. Part of the first ever national barefoot race series, Naked Foot 5K is a day full of events ranging from a free 1K fun run for kids, foot painting, Tarahumara bulb games, obstacle courses, green vendors, prizes, and the 5K race for adults. Soul for Souls encourages participants to bring their gently used footwear to be donated to people in need all over the world. For registration information, go to www.thenakedfoot5k.com. KCSB is a media sponsor for this event. Surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey.
Every Wednesday, beginning at 5 p.m., the Multicultural Center has free cookies, tea, and coffee, followed by a free film screening as a part of our cup of culture. This week, on Wednesday, May 11th, at 6 p.m., the Multicultural Center invites you to the screening of Harvest of Loneliness. This documentary gives accounts of the Bracero Program, a historical program that brought Mexican workers to the U.S. as temporary contract workers, and how this affected labor in the U.S. A discussion facilitated by one of the directors will follow the film.
Listen to
KCSB 91.9
FM in Santa Barbara.
Good morning, Santa Barbara. You're tuned in to KCSB 91.9 FM, and this is the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent Poodle Radio. Getting straight into our three segments today, you'll notice it's Thursday. Thursday as usual. And the new issue of The Indie is out. The cover story is on the homeless count, a subject we covered a few episodes ago with Isabel Walker, who writes about homeless issues for The Indie. Well, she's written this cover story as well. And she has done her usual thorough job. You know, the survey by Common Ground Santa Barbara was all about finding out what's actually going on with the homeless population in Santa Barbara. And That's what her career at the Independent's been about as well. So this is a very, very fortunate unifying of purposes, you might say. And to talk more about the homeless count today for our first segment, our cover story segment, we have Jeff Schaefer from the Uffizi Mission Project. He was involved with the homeless count. He's part of the South County's leadership team. He's done plenty of work with the homeless before as well. And we're going to ask him about all of that this morning. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And we should ask, we talked a little off mic about this before, but you covered a populated area in this South County team. You know, where what was the range you were involved in with the homeless count?
Our South County team primarily dealt with from Carpinteria up to Isla Vista. So that was primarily what I was in charge of, raising volunteers and coordinating efforts to do the vulnerability index and then get some of the data that you're going to read about in the upcoming weeks and is in the Independent.
Indeed, there's a whole data sidebar there in the Independent cover story. And first, I should ask about this. You know, in the story, Isabel writes how it didn't seem to be hard to get volunteers. A lot of people were willing to go out there early in the morning and talk to the homeless, figure out what's going on with them. That's a surprise. Why do you think there was so much willingness?
Well, I think a lot of the people that showed up, so I was involved mainly in the Santa Barbara City count. For three mornings in a row, people came from 4 a.m. to 7 a.m. to hit the streets and, you know, sit down with people on the streets and find out what their vulnerability was. A lot of those people came from the faith communities, or they came or they're younger. Mm-hmm. And some of them already had involvement. I would say a good percentage also had involvement already, or concern for people on the streets. So, you know, it's just really about mobilizing. I think they brought me on board because they felt like I could help with the grassroots part of it and get a lot of volunteers. So, yeah, we aimed for 500 and we got over 500 countywide to kind of join us, which was huge. And now we need more. We need at least that amount of people to stay involved with this as we move now towards housing people.
Right. And of course, we mentioned this in the last segment on the survey on the Common Ground homeless count, which is that the goal here is to get the homeless from a state of homelessness to a state of having a home. And I want to ask about your experience, but also first I want to, for people who didn't hear the last segment or who haven't read the story yet, haven't read about the survey, the issue of vulnerability, what actual conditions fall under, what makes up vulnerability? I'll put it like that.
There's a lot of things. There's mental health, physical health, how long people have been on the streets, age, specific illnesses people have. So when you sit down and do the vulnerability index with somebody, you're doing a 20-minute interview going through their entire medical history, how long they've been on the streets to discover, you know, what issues they're actually dealing with. So the more that you have, if you combine a mental illness and a physical illness and an addiction and an age, like if you've been on the streets for a long time, and I think, you know, we skewed our questions a little bit toward, you know, I can't remember the exact age, but the high 40s, you know, then your vulnerability goes up. So, you know, you have to remember in the past couple of years, this year we've seen 12 people pass on the streets. And the past years we've seen, you know, upward numbers of people passing on the streets. We've all felt like there's more vulnerability on the streets right now.
Doing this 20-minute survey about their medical history and their time on the streets, what kind of willingness did you find? I mean, were the majority willing to do this survey, or how many yeses and how much did it take to find members of the homeless population who would say sure, I'll sit down for 20 minutes?
Well, I think it was around 1,200 people. When you look at 1,100 and something, I believe, of people that actually did the vulnerability index with us, which is a good amount of people. You also had people who said they wouldn't want to take it, of course, as well. Right. But I think it was we were all trained on how to do the index, and the entire goal was relational. And the goal is not, I mean, when you talk about the goal is to get to know you and to help get people off the streets, more and more people are willing to give the information. We were all trained on how to do it in the proper way and not to shake anybody or not necessarily force anyone to wake up. But, you know, and the reason why we did it so early is you want to find the people who are actually on the streets. So you need to find them before they move on to somewhere else. We also did it in all the shelters, and we did it in, you know, RVs, people sleeping in cars. So tried to cover and get as many people as you could.
And you're out there with a team of how many when you get out there early in the morning looking for members of the homeless population? You know, what kind of a unit are you working with?
At least four people.
Four people.
So every team was at least four. Sometimes it would be five or six. That's just for safety issues. And then you can, if you need to move on in twos, there's always somebody else with you. So nobody went out and did it by themselves. And that's good, because then you're working together and you have somebody to debrief with, and, you know, it's more communal, you know.
Now, tell me a little bit about your history with working with the homeless or working with, you know, populations like that? What have been the kinds of things you've done in the past?
Well, it all started with meal sharing. So basically, we did a meal sharing starting at a library. We kind of got kicked out of the library because it was too public a space. We moved on to Alameda Park downtown. That was going well. And then we multiplied to another park called Pershing Park. And it was at Pershing Park where I became more educated on homelessness, and a lot of different faith communities joined in the meal sharing and began to provide meals. Doctors Without Walls joined us, so they're out there every Wednesday night, you know, dealing with medical needs. And so my experience has been every person on the streets has their own story, and we tend to look at stats or things like that to try to understand it. But and a lot of people on the streets, we need to learn from them too, because they've survived a lot of things. I don't know if I could have survived.
Right.
You know, many,
no kidding.
Many people going through foster care systems, not really ever having parents that care for them, being, you know, there's all kinds of reasons. And when you sit down and explore them individually with people, you get a better idea of what's really happening. And it's complex. You know, it's not,
right.
There's no one reason that that person becomes homeless. And that'll show in the stats as well. If you look at them, you'll see it's a multiplicity of issues you're dealing with.
It seems like, tell me if I'm right or wrong about this, but for someone to become homeless, there needs to be a few different issues piled together before that will happen, right?
Yeah, for the most part, you see, you know, multiple things happening, or we've just working with somebody who recently has found housing, who's been on the streets for 39 years since he was age 9.
So the streets, you know, they felt like home to him. A home doesn't feel like home.
Yeah. He's never experienced what we would call the kind of life we've had. And so now when he's housed, we have we have a team of people helping him shop or learn how to cook or use the microwave. I mean, those are things he's never owned. He's never had his own bed, in the sense, you know, so each story is its own story.
Now, this almost lifelong homelessness, is that a rarity, or is that sort of, that happens a lot, or is it the norm?
No, it's not the norm. You know, it's in the idea of chronic homeless, people who have been, I believe, homeless for at least a year or four times in a certain amount of years, you know, are considered chronic. And then you're dealing with a whole different issue. And I would say the people that we're trying to house probably would fit under the chronically homeless because they have a mental illness, they have an addiction, and they have a physical liability. Maybe. I don't know. I haven't seen the exact list now of the 100 that we would say are the most vulnerable right now, but that we're going to see that information pretty soon. Then we're going to start to house.
And I want to talk about that as well. But first, I want to mention one of the figures, just one statistic from the stats sidebar in the Independent story by Isabel Walker, which is that 57%, there was a 57% rate of mental illness.
Right.
And that's something just in the public sort of perception. It seems like the number almost, you'd think it would be higher because that's what you hear is the reason people become homeless. That's at least what I hear, you know, just keeping my ear out. But it's that, you know, it's that and it's drug addiction. But how important are those two factors? How prevalent are those two factors in homelessness from what you've seen?
Well, it looks from the stats that it's affecting one out of two people, right?
Right.
So if you're going down State Street and you're seeing people who are and I wouldn't talk about the street youth necessarily, but maybe some of the older people on the streets, you're one out of two people is going to have some issue there.
Right.
And then there usually is a lot. I mean, so people have more compassion towards the mentally ill and not so much compassion maybe toward the addicted. And I would just say that, you know, for the people I've talked to on the streets, there oftentimes is an occurrence in their life or an issue that has led to an addiction. And if you combine mental illness and addiction, then you have a real issue to look at and try to help people with.
And how much do you see that combination of both?
I would say from my experience at Pershing Park, wow, both together, you know, one or two out of 10, I would say that I know. Okay. I can just go off of my personal knowledge. And when you talk about mental illness, all the way from you're talking all the way from depression, which is probably higher in people on the street, because right. when you're on the street and you're trying to survive and find resources,
how
and
could you not
have
be
hope.
Depressed? Yeah.
So I think a lot of it has to deal with depression, which I would say is probably a higher number. I would boost the number up then if you're talking about depression and the ups and downs of that.
Now, for the stories you've heard with the homeless count, with the survey, with the work you've done otherwise, what causes homelessness if, in the cases where it isn't a mental illness and it's and they are clean, you know, and there's no addiction, what is it? What is it that happens?
That's anywhere from you know, a huge family breakup to the construction business went south. To losing, you know, to losing a home, to trying to decide between keeping your home or keeping your medical care, to, you know, and or it comes down to you lose your house and you're in your car and then somehow your car gets towed and you don't have your car,
right?
And then you're on the so that that's where it comes down to, like, the multiplicity of issues. There's like hundreds of stories I could hear that would be that story, you know?
By the way, if you've just tuned in, this is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent on KCSB 91.9 FM. I'm Colin Marshall. I'm speaking with Jeff Schaefer from the Uffizi Mission Project, who worked on the Common Ground Santa Barbara Homeless Survey, which is the subject of Isabel Walker's cover story in this current issue. Now, we've mentioned the process of getting the homeless population into homes. What's going on with that right at this moment?
Well, right now we're lining up the people, the landlords. We're lining up housing authority, both city and county. So we have a meeting next week to begin to line up finding our spots to house people. Then you have to line up the supportive services. You have to find the people who can help us with helping people who might have addictions or
right.
You know, getting how do you get people to appointments, or how do you get the people to their house, all those kind of issues. Then part of my job is to raise up volunteers. So my goal is to raise up teams of 8 to 10 people that become a support team for people once they're housed, who can call on them, say how you're doing, who can have coffee with them, just basically
right.
build a new support community. Because if you're on the streets, that is your support community, those people that you've been on the streets with. So if you pull them out of that community, you have to replace it with something so they don't end up going back. So that's kind of my role, is to raise up the volunteer teams.
How much, I want to get clear on how much is the dangers that remain when you have them in houses, and you talk about the community issues, of course, you
yeah.
know, their old friends might well not be in homes, right?
Right.
So what is the risk you perceive of them falling back into their old ways, even after they're already in a home?
Well, this is basically the housing first model. It's probably the most successful model that there is, as far as people not relapsing. But yeah, it all has to do with the supportive services and getting the right people to build the new community. And that's what I've seen. When we've been able to create new community for people once they are housed, then they're less likely to go back or have a desire to go back. And also know healthy boundaries when people want to visit them and be in their apartment that may potentially drag them backwards. You've got to work with them. So I would say, I think the Common Ground model is around 8 out of, it might be higher, but 8 out of 10 have retained their housing.
Oh, impressive.
Which is great. It's phenomenal, really.
Now, there's an issue that, I mean, I guess we have to confront directly, that the whole, it sounds like it was easier than expected to get volunteers for the survey, and then you're talking about getting volunteers now
yeah.
for someone to follow up with the community, but you have to get past the issue of the fear of the homeless population.
Yeah.
You know, people are scared of the homeless. I think
yeah.
we can just say that. And so is that a challenge when you're trying to find people to build a new community for the formerly homeless?
That will be a challenge. I think educating the community on the true nature of homelessness, and that there's probably as much danger from housed people as not housed.
Right.
You know, so
you know,
mean, come
I
on.
I think you got a point there.
Yeah. I mean, if we want to really study it, it might be more hidden there. My experience with people on the streets is, yeah, there's violent. There are a few, and they get the press. you know, or they of course, attention goes towards that.
Incidents seem to happen within the population, though. Is that correct or not correct?
Yeah, and then within the population, they themselves know who the dangerous people are, right, and who are not, you know. So part of it is training. I mean, part of it is I'm going to do a training for volunteers. It's not just going to be throwing them into it. It's going to be training on boundaries and what to look for and how to help. You know, there's a lot of issues. So,
right.
So, yeah.
You know, it sounds like, you know, after all this work you've done so far and with much more to go, it sounds like you're optimistic. What has made you optimistic about this project? Because not everybody is. Even people doing work with the homeless seem to be quite so optimistic about what can be done to help that population.
Well, I think it's a balance between. So for me, a lot of it comes down to my faith that,
right,
there's God behind it, you know,
right,
given the strength for it.
That's got to help.
That helps me personally and helps our team. And I think realistically, the more people I can educate and get involved, the more hopeful I am. Because without that, the problem is huge, you know, if you consider the numbers. But the more that we can get people involved to do their small part, if everyone will just take a small part, then I think we can succeed.
Now, let's say a listener wants to take their own small part. They want to get involved. Where can they go? Who can they talk to?
I would say if you go to the website, commongroundsb.org, mm-hmm, there's ways you can sign up. My contact information's on there. So that would be the main way, commongroundsb.org. Contact us through there. There's also a Facebook page, Common Ground Sound at Barbara on Facebook. So you can ask to join that. And then basically, we'll figure out ways to get you involved where you want, whether it be, you know, if you want to help financially, if you have certain skills that you can offer, or if you just want to volunteer and be part of one of these teams, that'd be incredible.
So even though the survey is over, there's plenty more to do.
Yeah, and the survey doesn't end because we're going to continue to do it, you
yeah,
know, as we house people.
Over.
Yeah, it's not going to end. And you know, someone asked me the other day, do you really think you can house 100? And countywide, from Santa Maria all the way down to Carpinteria, if we can't find 100 places, I would be surprised, actually,
right,
if we can't find 100 places to house people.
I've been speaking with Jeff, Jeff Schaefer from the Uffizi Mission Project. He was involved in the Common Ground Santa Barbara homeless count, or the survey, whatever you officially want to call it. It's the subject of the Santa Barbara Independence cover story this week. Jeff, thanks so much for taking the time
you.
This morning. This is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent on KCSB. I'm Colin Marshall. Stay tuned, more on the way, talking about environmental education for elementary schoolers and talking with a TV producer who is doing a documentary on a group of kids visiting from Alaska, visiting Santa Barbara and the lower 48 for the very first time. Stay tuned.
The UCSB Department of Art presents Ymir Brainsickly, a first-year MFA exhibition at the 479 Gallery and Project Space on the UCSB main campus. The exhibition runs from Tuesday, May 3rd through Wednesday, May 11th, 2011, with an opening reception on May 3rd from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Regular gallery hours are Monday through Friday from 12 to 4 p.m. and weekends by appointment. Ymir Brainsickly is an exhibition of first-year UCSB MFA candidates Bessie Kunath, Emily Harbaldier, Jay Healy, Jared Flores, Nicholas Lowen, Rima Samitis, Ruby Osorio, Tim Brown, and Von Tron. The work will feature a multifaceted approach to art making, including painting, installation, sculpture, animation, performance, and experimental soundscapes. In addition to the work of individuals, a collaborative food table display will add meaning and depth to the show's title. For high-res images, artist contacts, or more information, contact Tim Brown at 512-731-8605 or unotito@gmail.com. That's unotito@gmail.com.
You're tuned in to KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara.
Yes, it is. KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. We're right back to Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent on KCSB. And I should also refer to it by its alternate title as Mark Alvarado, the head of Pueblo, our guest last week, called it Poodle Radio, radio and nothing more. So if you prefer the other pronunciation, there's a whole different meaning. In any case, I'm Colin Marshall. We're back talking about an environmental education program for elementary schoolers, sort of combining the teaching skills of college students with the willingness to learn about the environment and nature of elementary schoolers. I think we can all remember the days when we were in elementary school. That's kind of a thing we wanted to learn about. So with me today, this morning, in the studio, I've got Ryland King. He's the founder and head director of Environmental Education for the Next Generation, or EENG. Ryland, welcome to the program.
Right on. Thank you so much, Colin.
Now, there's the article up on the online already. Some of us have read it. We both read it. Tell me what the goal of the program is.
The goal of the program is to instill environmental stewardship throughout the community from the youngest members of society up. And we plan to do that by running in first and second grade classrooms. Our first grade students learn about environmental science, and our second grade students learn about sustainability. And we give them the knowledge and tools to go out and change their daily habits and their everyday lives to reflect environmentally conscious habits. And what we plan to see happen is those kids, when they come home and they after they leave a room, they turn the lights off, they're going to have a type of need or want to tell their parents and families and friends to go about and do those same type of actions.
Now, when we were both little kids in elementary school, you know, we had classes on nature. There was some stuff about the environment there a little bit. You know, we heard PSAs that you should turn off the lights, that maybe don't use a lot of styrofoam. How do you step it up to the next level for this generation?
So without a doubt, when it's a whole different game when we come into the classroom. We take our kids from the regular standard of 30 students to one teacher, and we bring in 5 college student volunteers, which are probably the coolest age group you could ever imagine coming into the class.
Right.
And we break those kids into small groups of one college student instructor with 5 students. So that means that those kids that are usually left behind in their daily activities are now engaged, and they're engaged with somebody they can look up to. And beyond in those small groups, they have the program that runs for 8 weeks. So those kids really develop a type of a role model and mentor from the college age instructor. And we get the kids up and moving. We don't have them reading a book or filling out a worksheet.
Right.
We take the kids through fun and engaging activities and experiments and projects that all wrap back up into the overarching concepts of both units that we run with the different grades.
Now, tell me about the process of reaching out to elementary schools, because it sounds like in the article it was a pretty uphill at first, getting a school to be like, yeah, okay, come on in, you know. And this is, you're saying you want to volunteer for them and give kids a better environmental education, but even then they were kind of like, well, was that how that was?
In the beginning it was very hard. We didn't have too much direction, and luckily we are near UCSB, and we had the help of a couple, had the direction from a few education professors on campus, specifically Sue Johnson. And what she directed us to do was to tailor our lesson plans to California state standards, and all of our lesson plans now align specifically with California science state standards. And once we did that, the reception from the schools went from pretty much nothing to nearly 100%. They couldn't be happier to have the college now engaging with those public schools.
So before they were kind of like, well, are you sure it meets the X, Y's, and Z's?
Exactly.
And now they're like, yeah, we're sure. We got this. You look at this sheet of paper, right? You get some kind of certificate or something, or you just tell them we're matching all this?
We've been endorsed by the director of categorical programs from the Santa Barbara School District and the superintendent from the Goleta School District.
Now, you making a plan, I mean, that's one thing. You got a lesson plan, but bringing it into the battlefield, you know, bringing it into the first grade classroom, how did that work the first time, you know, when you first, the early times anyway, when you were getting the ideas going in actual practice? What did you find?
So we found that a lot of times I'll be working with our director of education, and we write up a lesson plan, and we figure that this activity is really going to work. And sometimes it doesn't work, and other times it does. It really depends on the classrooms that we go into. But what we do to make sure that our lesson plans are continually improving is we've put together an education team that's comprised of our lead instructors, and they meet once a week with our director of education, and they go over what worked and what didn't work in the classroom from the previous week with that lesson. And then our director of education takes all those comments and assessments together together and revamps that lesson plan, and I work with her the week after that to finalize that lesson. So our education, our lesson plans are continually improving every single week.
Now, what have you found works and doesn't work so far? Like, are there any patterns you can see, like, we should go a little more in this direction, maybe a little less in this one?
Mm-hmm. I think one of the biggest things is making the program as hands-on as possible. Mm-hmm. The reason we chose first and second grade is because when you're in kindergarten, children are being rationalized by society to sit in a classroom for 50 minutes and understand how to work and cooperate with one another. When they get into first and second grade, they begin to learn what 2 + 2 is or how to structure a sentence. And if we're able to ingrain or instill some type of environmental ethic in that age group when 2 + 2 is just being learned, it's going to become that intuitive when they get older. One thing that first and second graders know how to do is they know how to work with things that are hands-on. So we want to bring in the hands-on and interactive aspects to each of our lessons.
What kind of subjects are big hits? I mean, what sort of units or what sort of like sub-topics within the environment are just guaranteed to get the attention of a first or second grader?
Yeah, one of the best lessons, or one of the favorite lessons, not only from the kids, but the students and even the instructors that go into the classroom, is our lesson called The Importance of Bees. The children learn about the waggle dance, and they get to go out and actually do the waggle dance. And that's actually a real, I just got a text from an instructor yesterday, and he was reading through his biology book and said, I can't believe the waggle dance is real. And it's a dance that the bees do to communicate with one another where the pollen is located and actually how rich that pollen source is. So we hide a flower in the classroom and then have the class do a waggle dance to direct that other student to find the flower. And then we also tell the kids how bees communicate through smell. So each kid's, we have two smells. We have like coffee and strawberry, and the kids each get a cup, and then they go around and have to smell each other's cups to figure out which hives they're in. So I would say definitely The Importance of Bees is probably our highlight lesson for first grade. And then we go into second grade, and there's a great lesson called Water Conservation, where the kids learn about how to conserve water and how much of an effect they can have just when they brush their teeth in the morning. So we have the kids brushing their teeth, and when a lot of kids will leave the water on, and what we show them is we'll give the kids a toothbrush and that kid will brush his teeth, and then we'll be pouring water into cups as they brush their teeth, and we'll do it once while the water stays on, and it'll fill up about 20 cups, and then say we do it again and they turn the water off and we pull up the jug of water, and then it only fills up about one and a half cups.
Right.
And the kids go, oh wow, that's a big difference. So when they go home, they're going to know what size of a difference they're making.
See, I remember a PSA from childhood like 20 years ago, 22 years ago, with saying essentially, yeah, maybe don't leave the water running while you brush your teeth, but that's a more vivid image that you're giving the kids in this program. Like, they see it, you know,
exactly.
They're there, toothbrush in hand, you know. Mm-hmm. They look at it. By the way, if you've just tuned in, this is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent. I'm Colin Marshall. I'm speaking with Rylan King, founder and head director of an organization whose name I want to get exactly right, Environmental Education for the Next Generation, covered this week in the Indy, bringing college students into elementary school classrooms, teaching them about environmental science and the kind of things that kids maybe haven't been getting until recently. Now, is there the idea that, you know, these kids will grow up and pass it down, but also maybe that these kids will pass it up to their parents as well?
Without a doubt. I think that's our complete mission, is to inform and excite the students enough to where when they go home, they're going to want to pass on what we've given to them in the classroom, the school, the knowledge and the tools and the skills to go about living their everyday lives more sustainable, and they'll be able to share that with not only their friends but also with their family and their parents, and change the ways that those people work and live. And it's a really neat thing that we're able to reach out to the public schools, because we get to hit upon every single demographic, whether it be somebody who's already an environmentalist or somebody who's not as conscious of the environmental movement, because we're reaching out to all the different kids in those public schools. So I think it's really special that we have a chance to to reach out beyond just the traditional environmental demographic and really hit upon the families that want and need to become a part of the solution.
Now, how technical or how much of the hard facts can you get across to a first and second graders? Like, you know, environmental science, it sounds imposing to a lot of people, but, you know, you make it palatable for them. How much in terms of the pure knowledge can you get across versus sort of the practical, like, here's what you should do differently?
Without a doubt. I think it's obviously not a college class, and that was something that we had to get beyond our minds when we first began. But I think that the big thing is ingraining in them the appreciation and the awareness and the knowledge in first grade, where they can come out and be able to speak confidently about the natural systems and their natural surroundings. And then in second grade, that we want to give them the skills to go out and protect what they now appreciate and are aware of and have knowledge about. And then from the first grade and second grade out into the third grade, we want them to be participating and doing those things on their own. And we feel that if we bring the enthusiasm and the information into the classroom, those kids will go out and participate further into their lives.
Now, you know, you seem to show a lot of enthusiasm for teaching, but in the article you mentioned it was kind of by accident you got into it. So how was that? What was that accident that got you into teaching?
Yeah. When I was a freshman here, I'm now a junior, I was looking for the Environmental Affairs Board, which is the central student environmental group on campus. And I was walking around and actually got lost on campus, as many freshmen do. And I ended up running into the vice president of the External Office of Local Affairs. And I asked him where the Environmental Affairs Board was meeting. And he said, they don't meet for another 3 weeks. And right away said, I have an internship, hey, if you would like one. Right. And he told me I'm the vice president of blah, blah, blah. And I was kind of taken aback. So I said, can I just take your card and I'll see what happens? And so I took his card and I had his number and talked it over with my family and friends. And they said, this is an opportunity you have to take. There's not many freshmen that are going to have this opportunity or be able to do what you could do during your first year of college. So I ended up taking the internship, and what it was I got $1,000 to put on any community program that I wanted to put on, which ended up being something that's really changed my life. And then I got involved with the Environmental Affairs Board as it planned in the beginning, and they had an environmental education campaign where they would go into one classroom at Ivy Elementary and teach biweekly lessons. And we would write up those lesson plans every 2 weeks, and then we would go in and teach it, but we'd throw those lesson plans away after. And I found that the program was so beneficial, not only to the students that we were teaching, but to myself by going in there. It was so rewarding and fulfilling, and I was also learning how to speak publicly in front of children, and that helped me speak publicly in front of people in general. And I wanted to take those mutual benefits and expand it further. So getting lost really kind of put me on the right path.
The benefits of showing up early, I guess, like very, very early.
Yes.
Tell me about the involvement of the Dockers Company in the growth of this organization.
Yeah, so recently we were entered in the Dockers Wear the Pants contest, and that was a contest, an online contest for someone to carry out their passion, and they had a plan to give $100,000 for somebody to carry out their passion. And we, about 2 weeks ago, actually took the grand prize and won that contest, and big help through a Facebook vote and big help through the UCSB and Santa Barbara community.
And this allows the program to do what?
This now will allow the program to expand further. We've recently expanded out to San Luis Obispo, where we're now running in classrooms that have launched in April of last month. And next year, our plans are to expand out to 3 new cities. We're vetting cities in San Francisco, San Diego, Los Angeles, and Santa Cruz. And it looks like we should be starting up a chapter in San Francisco in September of next year.
So is this all part of an expansion, you know, first California, then get to the other 49, you know, and then see where it goes? And what are your ideas about, you know, best case scenario, what you're going to see this program do?
Yeah, I'm pretty confident where we are and the win-win benefits of the program and our capabilities to expand the program. I'd like to, the goals of our leadership right now is to expand the program statewide in the next 5 years. Right. And after that, we'd like to take it as far as it's going to go. So nationwide is definitely a vision right now, but we need to be focusing on on the present moment. So in the present right now, we're going to be focusing on taking it to three new cities and making sure those run and using those as a replicable model for expansion throughout the state over the next five.
And you only have to deal with California state regulations, right, as far as, I don't know how much they differ state to state, but comparatively easy to stay within California, right?
Yeah, without a doubt. It shouldn't be too hard. The big thing is having the right people running the program in the places that we want to go. And then as we want to expand to new areas, I feel that hitting those new standards in different states shouldn't be too hard because we'll already have the foundation laid in our curriculum.
And if people want to know more about this, is there anything on the web or anything they can look up?
Without a doubt. If you're interested in learning more about the organization, you can check out our website at www.eeng.org. And if you're interested in getting your son or daughter's classroom involved or your school involved with the program, you can contact us at infosb@eeng.org.
I've been speaking with Ryland King, founder and head director of Environmental Education for the Next Generation, EENG. Ryland, thanks for taking the time this morning.
Right on. Thank you so much, Colin.
This is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent. Stay tuned. Got more good stuff for you. Talking about some kids who are seeing not just Santa Barbara, but the lower 48 for the first time. Keep it here on Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent on KCSB 91.9 FM.
The Lebanese Club, Persian Student Group, and the Armenian Student Association are hosting events across the UCSB campus for the 4th Annual Middle Eastern Cultural Awareness Week, taking place this week. On Monday, May 9th, there will be a Middle Eastern music workshop, 6 p.m. to 8 p.m. at the UCSB Multicultural Center Lounge, where speaker Scott Marcus, director of the Middle Eastern Ensemble, will be discussing the different aspects of Middle Eastern music. Free drinks and snacks will be provided. Tuesday, May 10th, there will be a movie screening of a documentary about women artists in Iran from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m. at Embarcadero Hall. Free drinks and sweets are provided. Also Tuesday is a game night, 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the SRB Multipurpose Room. There will be various student groups teaching each other to play popular card and board games from the Middle East. Wednesday, May 11th, there will be a culture show, 8:30 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the Multicultural Center Theater. This will be the Persian Student Group's 33rd annual culture show, where there will be a variety of student performances displaying Iranian culture. Dinner and admission is free. Thursday, May 12th, there will be a Middle Eastern food fair, 12 p.m. to 1 p.m. at Stork Plaza, where there will be free Middle Eastern food from various student groups on campus. Middle Eastern Cultural Awareness Week will end Thursday, May 12th, with the Lebanese Performance Night at 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. at the MCC Theater. There will be various student performances, including live belly dancing and a performance by the Middle Eastern Ensemble. Dinner and admission is free for the final event.
On Wednesday, May 18th, UCSB's Multicultural Center's weekly Cup of Culture presents a screening of the documentary COINTELPRO 101, starting at 6 p.m. A discussion with co-director Claude Marx and former Black Panther Hank Jones follows the film, which is being co-presented by KCSB-FM and UCSB's Department of Asian American Studies. COINTELPRO is an acronym for Counterintelligence Program, which was a series of covert and often illegal projects conducted by the FBI from the mid-1950s into the 1970s. The term is also frequently used to describe a conspiracy among local, state, and federal agencies to destroy movements for self-determination and liberation for Black, Brown, Asian, and Indigenous struggles, as well as mount an institutionalized attack against allies of these movements and other progressive organizations. It represents the state's strategy to prevent movements and communities from overturning white supremacy and creating racial justice. COINTELPRO 101 will introduce viewers to the history of social justice movements in the 60s and 70s. For more information on the May 18th screening of COINTELPRO 101, visit mcc.sa.ucsb.edu.
The UCSB Department of Art presents Humir Brain Sickly, a first-year MFA exhibition at the 479 Gallery and Project Space on the UCSB main campus. The exhibition runs from Tuesday, May 3rd through Wednesday, May 11th, 2011, with an opening reception on May 3rd from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. Regular gallery hours are Monday through Friday from 12 to 4 p.m. and weekends by appointment. Humir Brain Sickly is an exhibition of first-year UCSB MFA candidates Bessie Kunath, Emily Harbaldier, Jay Healy, Jared Flores, Nicholas Lowen, Rima Samitis, Ruby Osorio, Tim Brown, and Van Tran. The work will feature a multifaceted approach to art making, including painting, installation, sculpture, animation, performance, and experimental soundscapes. In addition to the work of individuals, a collaborative food table display will add meaning and depth to the show's title. For high-res images, artist contacts, or more information, contact Tim Brown at 512-731-8605 or unotito@gmail.com. That's unotito@gmail.com.
You're tuned in to KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara.
This is KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. My name's Colin Marshall, and you are tuned in to the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent Poodle Radio. We have a packed house in the studio this morning. Let me tell you, for this third segment, you might have heard a little about this already, but a group of school kids has come down to Santa Barbara to hang out, enjoy the place, see the lower 48 from, you know, what a Santa Barbaran would consider the best place to see the lower 48. There's so much I want to ask about this, but let me introduce first the guest in here with me in the control room. Debbie, you're the lead teacher of this class who's visiting Santa Barbara. Tell us about the place they come from.
These children come from a small native village, 40 people total, on an island in the middle of the Kuskokwim River. We're about 300 miles, I believe, north of Bethel, and they live we have a lot of computers and things so that they can see things, but they cannot experience them firsthand, and that's why we came down here.
Now, tell us, who have we got there in Studio A across the glass?
Okay, you have Brad Gusty, a junior. You have Elizabeth Willis, a seventh grader. Mary Bobby, an eighth grader. And Brittany Bobby, a fourth grader.
We've got three of them on the mic. Welcome, welcome, and welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks.
So I want to get your guys' perspective so far on Santa Barbara. You know, it's easy to forget what this place is like living here. I've been here 8 years. Tell me, what is Santa Barbara like?
For me, Santa Barbara is, you know, a whole new place and like something I haven't been to before or seen. And it's really nice. Enjoying the weather, but it's kind of hot.
Well, it's a lot different from the village. Like, there's a lot more people and cars and, yeah.
Well, Santa Barbara is really cool and different from our village because it's just so small and there's more people. It's just bigger.
And this is going to be something that people are listening, you know, driving by in their cars in Santa Barbara are going to be fascinated by. I mean, I think they want to hear more about where you're from. They hear, you know, it's a small place. They hear it's in Alaska. They probably can't even envision Alaska. So, I mean, what do you want to tell us in Santa Barbara about where you come from?
Let's see. There's houses, and then I think there's like a truck or so, just like one truck.
One truck?
Yeah.
Really? What does that truck carry? Do you have any idea?
That truck doesn't work anymore because the battery's...
One truck dead. And it doesn't run?
Yeah, it used to run.
Wow.
But then the battery died.
Well, we use four-wheelers and snow machines and boats and stuff like that, though.
And I want to also get this in here. I have standing behind me in the studio, I have Mike Warner, who's doing a documentary on this on this whole event. I mean, I think I'm not. It's not too much to call it an event. To this journey the school kids have taken here to Santa Barbara, Mike. What do you see? What do you see in this story?
Wow, there's a lot to see in this story. I think that I certainly see the commitment and the dedication of a school teacher who saw the value in teaching her school kids to dream big. This is a big, big trip and a huge Right. undertaking for them, and to work hard to achieve their dreams. And, you know, I see also the just an outpouring of love and support from the community of Santa Barbara. They've been able to do so many things and see so many things because people have just really taken these kids to heart and wanted to show them the very best time they could. And I also see the, sort of in this story, the opportunity that we each have to make an impact on other people's lives when we just step out and do something for another person, do something good for another person. I see these kids who have a very different lifestyle from our own. I see them just blossoming and opening up, and I see their eyes being opened to so many experiences here in Southern California that I think will have the potential to change not only their lives, but also the life in their village moving forward for years to come.
Okay, guys, across the glass here, tell me some of the stuff you've done in Santa Barbara so far, just in this whole trip. I mean, what are some of the cool things you've had going on?
Well, yesterday we went to Magic Mountain and rode the roller coasters and
Nice.
Went through the water park. No, not the water park, but the water rides.
Nice, nice. That's a classic stop in Southern California. What else have you done around here?
We've been to the mission
of course.
A few days ago. That was really nice.
It's the place everybody must see in Santa Barbara, naturally.
Yeah, no, it's great.
We went ice skating into Westmont College, and we're going to the museum today.
Zoo.
Oh, the zoo.
Right. I mean, you've had a pretty full schedule, it sounds like. And it sounds like into something else you want to mention there?
Oh, we also went horseback riding. The Reagan Museum.
Right. You've had a variety of experiences. And I mean, Mike, you're capturing all this, right, for the documentary. This is a more packed trip than I think I've had anywhere. You're getting it all?
Yeah, we haven't been able to follow every single activity that they've done, but we have, you know, we started off in Stony River. We took a trip there a couple of weeks ago just before they left to get a sense of the place that they come from.
Right.
And then traveled back here with them on the plane and saw the wonder and amazement, you know, in the Seattle airport and at LAX for sure. you know, their first look at curbs and concrete parking structures and the variety of flowers and plants that we have here. And we've been following them as they do their activities here in Santa Barbara in Southern California.
Now, so listeners get an idea of the scope of this trip. I mean, how long do you have going around the West Coast before you go back home?
I think we're heading home on the 15th.
Yeah.
Okay. What remains, I mean, what are you still looking forward to as far as what you're going to be doing here in California?
Disneyland.
Nice. Now, that's a place you had to have heard things about back home, right?
Yeah.
But I want to also get a sense of what you did hear back home about California, about the lower 48, about what kinds of things were here. I mean, what did you know before you came, I guess?
It's a big city and lots of people.
I don't really know how to explain it.
Right, yeah, because see, it's you get certain, I mean, it's true for anybody who wants to go anywhere. I mean, not even limited to this situation, but you sort of think about where you're going. And tell me if this is a theme in the documentary as well, Mike, but, you know, you never really know what you're going to see until you get there, right? I mean, same with the documentary. You don't know how the story's going to shape up until you've got the thing shot, right?
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think that, you know, I've certainly seen a transformation with these kids. they had a sense, some sort of sense from books and from the internet about what Disneyland would be, what California would be. But if you don't have, if all the, your only experience is through books or a computer, the actual experience is very different. I'm thinking about when they first arrived, there was a potluck at Carpinteria State Beach, and watching the kids touch the sand with their own feet for the first time and watching them play in the water, we take it so for granted. And to see the expression on their face and to sort of be able to capture that on film and to be able to share that with others, it really is very different from, I think, their conceptions and their preconceived notions. And similarly, I think that we here in the lower 48 have preconceived notions about what life in a small village in the Alaskan bush is like and what teaching.
I have no idea at all. I mean, I wish I had a preconceived notion, right? But I want to ask Debbie as well. I want to ask you again about a couple of things, but first, there's someone else here we have in the Studio A who hasn't been on the mic yet. I don't know, do we want to get her on the mic? Because it seems like she might have something to say as well. But while we're working that out, I will ask you, Debbie, you know, I asked them about kind of what their impressions were about here. And Mike talked a bit about what our impressions might be of there. But, you know, what have you seen about the way both sides have found out more about the places they didn't know about, I guess is the best way I can put it. Not very articulate, but do you see what I mean by that?
Right. This project was to open eyes for our students. It actually is an elementary program. When I started working with the kids, I would ask a question, I would get one answer, and everybody would say the same thing.
Right, yes.
And I really got worried about that, and I'm like, okay, what is this? And it finally dawned on me, they did not have the experiential background that a lot of our kids do. Yes, we can read, we can look at it on DVD or whatever else, but it doesn't change when you go to the beach and you find out it really is salty. You know, that was a shock to the kids when they went to take that horse ride, and poor old Tyrell, you know, I don't want to be first, it's Mary's birthday, put her up first, because that horse was big. You know, many things, the kids are really, really excited. They get there, they're not sure they want to do it. They do it and they find it's wonderful.
We've all had that experience, though, haven't we?
Exactly.
I mean, it's true of us all. It's just in a different place they came from, different place they came to.
Exactly.
Now tell me, who have I got up on the right in Studio A now? There, I can almost see her if I stand up a little bit.
That's Brittany, one of my fourth graders this year. Brittany's keeping her journal so she can write next year, and again, so we can go back through this, relive this, and add more details.
Brittany, welcome to the program. Now you're keeping a journal. What are you putting in that journal?
The stuff that we did today and others.
Anything particularly that you have enjoyed so far?
Horseback riding.
Naturally. How could you not enjoy that though, right? What else goes? I mean, what else so far? I know it's early to ask you what your best memories have been of this trip, but, you know, what do you keep thinking about what you've done so far here?
Going to Magic Mountain again.
It sounds like the Magic Mountain experience. That had to be completely the most different thing from what they'd come from.
Right. Well, when we went into Magic Mountain, I stayed with the elementary kids. We split the high school and upper school and a middle school off because my middle school is all girls. My upper school is all boys. Mm. And the boys immediately headed for the roller coasters. The girls were not sure. The elementary kids didn't even want to talk about it. So bumper cars is where they wanted to go. So we hit the log jammer first, took our first bath. And then by the time we came around to the bumper cars, I had two who thought about going on Goliath, and they did. By the end of the day, all of the kids had tried a roller coaster, and I only have one, my youngest, who is not sure he likes them.
Right. Well, many people aren't sure they like roller coasters.
Right. But a lot of them, it was just, you know, looking at it, and it's scary. Okay, can we overcome that? Because, again, to come out of the village, everything is scary. So we've got to be able to get out there, say, okay, what am I going to do? Find somebody who's going to help me, and then go ahead and go through that fear.
Now, we're pushing this right up toward the end of the program, but I, you know, there's even more I want to know, and there's going to be more. there's going to be more in the Santa Barbara Independent about this. And of course, by the way, I've been speaking with Mike Warner, who's doing a documentary on Debbie and her students who have visited Santa Barbara, who have visited California, who are doing a West Coast trip. And, you know, I do want to thank you all for coming, and I want to make sure to get the full roll call again of the students. So, Debbie, we've had with us here again.
Okay, I have Brad, junior at Gusty Michael School, Elizabeth Willis, 7th grader at Gusty Michael School, Mary Bobby, 8th grader at Gusty Michael School, and Brittany Bobby, 4th grader at Gusty Michael School.
Well, thank you guys for taking the time to come on the program, and good luck with the rest of the trip, and I hope you enjoy the heck out of it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Poodle Radio, the radio program of the Santa Barbara Independent on a KCSB 91.9 FM. Oh, we're already past 9 o'clock, but you know, I got to go past the time limit when I have a segment like this. It's too good to resist. Be sure to tune in every Thursday, 8 a.m. until 9 here on KCSB 91.9 FM for more Santa Barbaran goodness.